And welcome back. When we hear the words Wall Street, a variety of impressions likely follows, not all of them are positive. Wall Street was central to the Great Depression of the 1930s and to the more recent Great Recession. On the other hand, it's an engine that drives the economy, giving the corporate world a financial transfusion that keeps its collective heart beating. Our next guest has written a new book giving us an historical perspective on Wall Street and the men who made it what it is today, for better or for worse. The book is Wall Streeters, the Creators and Corruptors of American Finance, and the author is Edward Morris, a former investment banker and former dean of the business school at Lindenwood University, where he now teaches finance. Ed Morris joins me in studio. Ed, nice to have you with us. Thank you.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
Quite a project, trying to figure out the 14, I guess, most influential people on Wall Street since day one.
Well, it's a project. It's also a Solomon-like decision, you know, say, who am I to make those decisions? But the research was a lot of fun, and the 14 people spanning from the turn of the century, the last century, to today all have had fascinating lives, and it took me about 5 or 6 years to write the book, and I feel like I've been living with those 14 people for a long time now.
Yeah, I'd say we should point out it is a series of short biographies of these people, starting with J. Pierpont Morgan. We'll get into some of the individuals in a moment, but give me some sense of how Wall Street evolved from the early days until where we are today.
The process has been one of growth and an expansion of mission. At one time, Wall Street was, which is now synonymous with high finance in America. At one time, it was at the tip of Manhattan, just a small area around Wall Street, and that's where most of, you know, Pierpont Morgan's work was done. A little bit in Philadelphia, a little bit in Boston, but that's where it was. What it has evolved to is similar to thinking of Hollywood. You think of Hollywood as an area of California, but nowadays you think of it as the motion picture industry. So Wall Street is really the total industry. But what my book attempts to do is to talk about how it evolved from where stocks and bonds were sold and companies were financed into this very large industry that includes hedge funds and shadow banking and index funds and private equity, a very diverse, very large, all-encompassing financial network.
But, you know, this is an area that gets a lot of eyes rolling in this country, because most of us don't understand hedge funds and derivatives and some of the things that you've talked about here, that these people who run the show, the bankers, if you will, and the Wall Street financiers, they have a distinct advantage over the rest of us.
Well, probably. And what you really touch on is the motive for writing the book.
Yeah.
Is that back in 2008, with the financial crisis really just getting underway and at its height, I decided that what I wanted to do was find some way to make it understandable for the vast majority of us that really are, as you say, puzzled by all these things, derivatives and so mm-hmm. forth. And it coincided with, at Lindenwood, we have an intersessional course in January that's optional for our students that can take some topic and cover it, some special interest topic. So I thought in January of 2009 would be a good time to try this, to see if I could portray Wall Street in ways that were understandable. And that was great, you know, an idea that latched on to. And I looked for some books, I looked for some sources, and there really weren't many, of course. And so I remembered back to my youth that there was a book that I loved when I was a youngster called The Microbe Hunters, about the men who were instrumental in developing the field of bacteriology and so forth, and Robert Koch and Walter Reed and Louis Pasteur. And that was really fun to read. Then when I was in college, there was a book that I enjoyed greatly in my economics course called The Worldly Philosophers, where it was many biographies of men from Karl Marx to Adam Smith all the way up to the current day. And I said, maybe that's an idea. Maybe that's the way to do it, to make finance understandable the same way these other topics became much more understandable and enjoyable to me. So I set on the idea of finding individuals who really were key in developing Wall Street.
We can't obviously talk about all of them, but let's talk about a couple of them. There are good guys and there are bad guys. One thing we should point out, they're all guys. It's not until fairly recently that women have played a more prominent role.
Right.
But who are some of the bad guys and why?
The bad guys are, I would say, the ones who took good ideas to excess. If we look at hedge funds, for instance, the first hedge fund was a very modest idea started by somebody who was a PhD in sociology, of all things. But he put together a fund with the idea of preserving wealth, as they say in the stock market. Buying stocks can make you rich. Hedge funds can't keep you rich. And that was the idea. He called it a hedged fund. And his name, Alfred Winslow Jones, and he was a remarkable man who came up with this idea. I would say the bad guys are the people who have driven hedge funds into an extreme in many cases, followed that pattern, but really departed from it and went to extremes.
Excuse me for just a moment, but I'm not sure that everybody, even though it's been talked about and written about a lot, I'm not sure that everybody knows what a hedge fund is.
Well, I'm not sure people even on Wall Street know, because they have moved so much from the idea of a fund that is going to protect your investments from volatility to one that is basically a catch-all name for any kind of venture you want to get into, from some kinds of venture capital to being a buyout artist to accumulating money on various kinds of very sophisticated derivative transactions. I know I'm not helping a lot here.
Well, but then we can talk about what derivative transactions are.
Right.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah. So the whole idea of excess probably is most familiar to us in the mortgage-backed securities, and one of the guys that I described, Louis Ranieri, came up with the idea of a mortgage-backed security, and that just means that you take a bunch of residential mortgage loans and you put them in a bundle and you sell that bundle, usually to institutional investors. A good idea as far as getting liquidity to the mortgage market, good for home ownership, lots of things to commend it. The problem was when the idea was taken to excess and when it became, believe it or not, a $12 trillion market before it was over, there became so much demand for these mortgage-backed securities that Wall Street really had to come up with new ideas, new products, and hence the deterioration in the quality of those mortgage-backed securities, the subprime loans that we're all familiar with, became part of those bundles that they sold.
You know, in talking about this, I can't get out of my head the film Wall Street and Michael Douglas playing Gordon Gekko saying, greed is good, greed is good. Does greed drive a lot of what we're talking about here?
Oh, I think it does. Yeah. I think it does. And that kind of gets into the regulation, because the regulatory aspects of Wall Street, because it is a business that is driven by the nice way to say it is creating value, but getting rich, mm-hmm. is a large part of it. And so ever since the turn of the century, since J. Pierpont Morgan's time, there has been discussion about how do we regulate, how do we kind of harness in what is going to be the animal spirits or the natural greed that I think people have as far as investments in Wall Street.
Is it possible that some of these things are so complicated that the people who create them, don't fully understand them, and that can get them into trouble?
Oh, I think that so. In the mortgage-backed securities, some of the smartest people on Wall Street, including the rating agencies, it's really doubtful that the people who were determining that these mortgage-backed securities, for instance, were AAA rated, meaning the highest quality bond rating, truly understood them. There's probably reason to believe the people who were packaging them in the hurry to put together more and more products because of the demand that was created were putting together packages of collateralized debt obligations and all these strange things where they didn't fully understand what it was, but packaged it.
Yeah. I have to bring this up, and I hope you understand why I do this. But you had a little trouble yourself at one point in your career, did you?
I did. Yes.
Yeah. And what was that? What was that all about? I mean, that was what I would call a misstep. But it was a costly one for you.
Oh, it was a big misstep. I was in the investment banking business, and one of my clients was a savings and loan, and I eventually became the chairman of that savings and loan. And it was really right in the period when, in the late 80s, when things were changing as far as the regulatory outlook. And so, yeah, and the SNL, the Germania Bank, failed. And in the aftermath, I spent, years defending myself, ultimately unsuccessfully. Mm-hmm. And so that was not, certainly not a pleasant experience. But I came out from it, and I didn't want to go back and probably couldn't have gone back into that industry, but have had just a wonderful 15-year career now as an academic.
Well, what did you learn from that experience?
I learned that your ambition needs to be checked. Mm-hmm. And in my case, I did not do anything that was illegal or immoral or unethical, in my opinion, but clearly, there was a drive for success, and I think that one of the things that I would like to impart to my students a little bit who are coming out of business school is that you really have to check that ambition and make sure that it's channeled in the correct directions.
I suppose an experience like that would have been helpful in writing this book in terms of some of the people that you write about.
Well, I think so, and this book, a lot of it was written, I guess, in real time, and that I can identify, and I certainly can see the, when we talked about the excess, I can relate to that personally, sure. Mm-hmm.
You did spend some time in prison.
I did, yeah.
Right. Well, let's put that behind us and get back to some of the other things going on. 2008, obviously, 2007, 2008 was a pivotal time in our most recent history. Can you give me a little more insight as to Wall Street's role in that? I mean, there are so many different things going on. We've talked about hedge funds. We've talked about derivatives and all the rest of it. How are the strings being pulled?
Well, I think one of the as far as the strings being pulled, I think the there during that time there really was a great deal of deregulation, and I describe in my book how the regulatory system came about, starting in the New Deal legislation and the formation of the Federal Reserve. But over time, until we got to 1999, especially without getting into too much technical detail here, there used to be something called the Glass-Steagall Act that separated commercial banks from investment banking and two very different kinds of businesses. And I think one of the key things was the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999, which had a role in creating the monstrously large financial institutions that we have today. And so I think as far as pulling the strings, I think that, a lot of it was political, and a lot of it was attempts to reduce the regulation that we had that had put us in such good order for so many years.
Well, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, putting these two entities under one roof, the temptation must have been enormous for these large banks and what have you to take advantage using one to influence the other.
Well, I think so. And I mean, in the simplest terms, I think the problem, in addition to sheer size, and sheer size is not necessarily a problem, but you when you combine two different kinds of cultures, the commercial banking business used to be considered, you know, rather boring, frankly, and then the investment banking is where the more adventuresome things were done, the trading, underwriting securities, and the riskier part of it. When you brought it together, culturally, the investment bankers usually prevailed as far as who's running the show. Mm-hmm. And so they had the access to government insured deposits to finance kind of casino type operations.
Right. How, the temptation had to be
overwhelming.
Should Glass-Steagall be reinstated?
I think it should, yeah. And there's actually a bill in the Senate now, sponsored, no surprise, by Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders is part of that to reinstate, but also John McCain, Republican. So there is a sense that we need to, if not reinstate Glass-Steagall in its original form, to do something similar. And what's really interesting is to me is that the last person I profiled in my book, Sandy Weil, who put together the Citigroup, and Citigroup, when it required the largest government bailout in history, and he is the one who called himself at one point the shatterer, meaning of Glass-Steagall, and in 1999, and he used to have a big plaque in his office. But today he has a different opinion. He was interviewed on CNN, CNBC, one of those networks in the last year or two, saying, I think what we should do is separate the commercial banks from the investment banks.
Hello.
So yeah. Now you tell us. But, yeah.
Right. Should someone have gone to prison for all of those goings on in the late part of the last decade?
I don't know.
No investment bankers. Nobody was ever charged with anything.
Well, again, I guess coming back to my own experience, there were over 1,000 individuals connected with the savings and loan business who were indicted with right. really a much smaller crisis compared to what's going on now. So, I wouldn't want anybody to go through the experience that I went through. But it is curious that with a much bigger problem and that nobody has really been indicted, much less convicted.
I think there are an awful lot of people in this country who feel that didn't happen because they have the money, they have the resources to keep that from happening. The famous 1%.
Yeah, and our senator from over in Illinois, Dick Durbin, just flat out has said they own the place. Right.
Is there a hero in your book of the 14?
Oh, there are a number of heroes.
I mean, to you, the most heroic.
The most heroic, tough choice, because as I said at the start of this, I feel like I know them all. They're part of a family. But I really think Jack Bogle. Jack Bogle is still alive. He's in his 80s now. And he is the person who created an index fund and really made it possible for small investors to participate in the stock market on a very economical and sensible basis.
I'm going to try to get one quick call in here. Good. Because I think Mike in St. Louis brings up a subject we should discuss, if only briefly. Mike, go ahead, but make it quick, please.
Yeah. Hi, Don. Hi. And your guest. My thesis has been over a number of years that the Federal Reserve basically has managed our economy to the benefit of the big guys and the operator. It's basically transferred the risk of the marketplace to the public and enabled corporations to always be in business in spite of the fact that they should fail. Credit default swaps, to me, were simply businesses doing what they had to do in a competitive marketplace. And eventually, I mean, they were just playing the game they were given. So that's my thesis, and I wonder how you feel about that.
Thank you, Michael. That's a thesis that many people share, and frankly, I don't, because I really think that the 2008 crisis that we had the Fed in the fog of war didn't do everything right. I think that absent a Federal Reserve system such as we have now, I think that it could have been as bad as the 2008 crisis was. I think it could have been much, much worse. I'm not sure where we would be if those actions, though not perfect, had not been taken.
We only have about a minute left. And again, some of these things we talk about can be quite complicated. But what do you want the average reader to take away from your book? And will the average reader be able to understand all of the things you're talking about?
Absolutely.
That's what's called a softball.
I appreciate it. What I want the average reader to take away is they're not, after reading my book, they're not going to understand derivatives or hedge funds or any of those things fully, but they're going to have an appreciation. What I want them to take away is the appreciation of how it works, for better, for worse, the way you open the program, and to take what is a foreign language to many people and making it much more understandable.
All right. Well, I think it will do just exactly that. Ed Morris, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Let me remind everyone that the name of the book we're talking about is Wall Streeters, The Creators and Corruptors of American Finance. And there are certainly plenty of examples of both sides in that book. Ed Morris will be signing his book, by the way, this Thursday at 5 o'clock, 5 p.m. at Lindenwood University's Business School, where he is currently employed. Ed Morris, thanks so much for being with us. Congratulations on the book. Good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
Right. That's it for us for today. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Percy Green about his civil rights activism during the building of the Gateway Arch. We'll also hear from the daughter of the arch architect, Eero Saarinen. We're excited to let you know, by the way, about a new project published today. The St. Louis Public Radio Newsroom's coverage of the Arch's 50th anniversary is now in one easy spot for you to explore on our site. See great historical photos and meet important figures in the Arch's past, present, and future at stlpublicradio.org. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.